Greetings, Metropolitans. You're listening to episode 2 of Flights and Tights, a Superman movie podcast. I'm Jessica Plummer.
And I'm Rebecca Goldberg.
And today we're going to be talking about 1980s Superman 2, starring Christopher Reeve, Margot Kidder, Gene Hackman, and Terrence Stamp, and directed by, let's say, Richard Donner and Richard Lester. Two dicks for the price of one. So before we get into talking about today's film, we did want to briefly touch on a couple bits of live-action Superman news that we've gotten recently. Rebecca, would you like to tell the crowd?
Absolutely. So first, there was an announcement of a new show called Metropolis on DC's streaming service yet to be named, but that will also feature Teen Titans or Titans and Young Justice Outsiders. But the interesting thing about this is that it's a prequel series taking place in Metropolis following Lois Lane and Lex Luthor, but before Superman shows up. We don't know much else beyond that. And then also, in the last couple weeks, we got a new trailer for Krypton, the series on Sci-Fi, which takes place, as you may expect, on Krypton, about Jor-El's father, who receives a message from the future about his son, so he has to save the rebellion?
It's unclear. It's real unclear.
It comes out near the end of March on the Sci-Fi Channel. But what's interesting about both of these, from the point of view of us talking about all these Superman adaptations, is that both of them sort of right around the existence of Superman take place beforehand, the Smallville curse, if you will, and paired with Supergirl, which has dealt with Superman but took a little while to do it. It feels like DC is afraid to tell Superman stories right now.
Well, they haven't done a great job recently. Like, that's why we started this podcast. Everything that they've made poor Henry Cavill do has been a disaster. So I kind of get it. And I also, you mentioned Smallville, which is an obvious comparison. And from the point of view of, hey, this show ran for 10 years and made us a lot of money, I understand wanting to replicate that. But from the point of view of, hey, this show was bad, and the longer it went, the more ridiculous it was that we weren't getting to the meat of the story, makes me wonder, like, why they would open the door to that not just once, but twice.
Arguably, the stalling till you get to Superman stuff was the worst thing about Smallville. It was absolutely insane by the end. Booster Gold flew on Smallville before Superman did.
Right? We had the Justice League and the Justice Society before. Like, get it together, Clark.
In that universe, Superman is Supergirl's cousin. Like, she was first.
Which, I mean, I'm fine with that because if I haven't said it already, Supergirl is my favorite character. But it's also completely ludicrous. I would also, if you would, for our audience, please read the sentence from the DC website, because I love it so much and I've already made you read it twice.
The announcement for the Metropolis TV show on DCComics.com starts, "Have you ever wanted to visit Metropolis? That bustling city of tomorrow, known to comic book fans worldwide as one of the biggest cities in the DC universe and home to the high-flying Man of Steel?" Which just sounds like a tourism ad for Metropolis, which is kind of lovely.
That's amazing. Like, if they steer into that curve, I'm there. I will watch every episode. I mean, I'm going to watch every episode because it's about Lois Lane and Lex Luthor, but I will enjoy the episodes.
It's just showing off different parts of Metropolis that you can visit if you too are fictional.
I just want to ride around on a little monorail and have like a helpful robot point out, like, here we have Suicide Slum, where newsboys sell papers in 2018 for some reason.
Here we have a very ornamental skyscraper that's just for one newspaper.
Here we have Bibbo Babowski.
I would not say no to Bibbo being on Metropolis.
It would be amazing. But instead, we'll probably get Otis.
That's very true. Speaking of...
Yes, let's talk about this actual movie. So, Superman 2, Electric Boogaloo. And strap in, because we have a whole list of these that you're going to have to listen to. Before we start talking about the actual film, we should explain that, as some of you may know, there are two versions of this movie. Originally, Richard Donner, who directed the first Superman movie, was supposed to film 1 and 2 simultaneously. And he did complete what he says was about 75% of Superman 2 back in 1977. But when it came time to finish the film in 1979, the producers, this father and son team of Alexander and Ilya Salkind, fired Donner and replaced him with Richard Lester, who had been assisting him on the first Superman movie, but who's best known for the Beatles movies Help and A Hard Day's Night. And there's all sorts of he said, they said about what exactly went down and who shot what and who got fired, why. And certainly the Salkinds were sketchy dudes who got sued by like half the major figures involved with the first film, including Marlon Brando and Christopher Reeve. But you can find all that history on the internet or in books about Superman, and we'll have some further reading listed in the show notes. The point is, Lester completed the remaining sequences and reshot some of the existing scenes so that it all hung together, and also so that his footage would make up at least 51% of the finished product, otherwise he couldn't be credited as the official director of the film. So for nearly 30 years, fans have been talking about this original Donner footage, which was sitting in warehouses somewhere, trying to track it down, putting pressure on Warner Brothers to release it. And then in 2006, to coincide with the release of Superman Returns, which is very much a continuation of Donner's sort of original vision, there was finally enough critical mass behind this movement that the old footage was found, and Donner and his original editor were allowed to recut it their way. Now, since they'd never shot the whole thing, the Donner edit is sort of a patchwork of Donner footage that we'd seen before, unused Donner footage, Lester footage, and even some screen tests that they kind of edited together, even though the actors were not actually in the same room at the time. But it does manage to construct a new narrative, and it's a pretty significantly different finished product. So we're going to talk about the Lester version first, because that's the one that most people have known for nearly 40 years now. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Donner version and how it compares. So Rebecca, do you want to talk about the plot of the theatrical release?
Yeah, so we'll get to the differences in the Donner version later, but the theatrical release starts with Superman saving Paris from a nuclear bomb. He throws the bomb into space, and the resulting explosion frees the criminals trapped in the Phantom Zone, who are General Zod, Ursa, and Non, who were first introduced briefly in the first Superman movie. While they make their way to Earth, Lex Luthor, completely separately, escapes from prison, deduces that Superman's headquarters are at the North Pole, and discovers the Fortress of Solitude. Meanwhile, Clark and Lois are sent to Niagara Falls on an assignment. Lois, while they're there, starts to suspect that Clark is Superman and even throws herself into essentially Niagara Falls, so he'll have to save her. But he manages to save her without giving away a secret identity. But back at the hotel, all that effort is for nothing because he trips and falls and lands with his hands in a burning fireplace. Lois sees that his hands weren't burned, so the jig is up. He takes her to the Fortress of Solitude. He talks to a hologram of his Kryptonian mother, Lara, who tells him that he'll have to give up his superpowers if he wants to be with Lois. So he steps into the fortress's superpower, removing Red Sun chamber. He becomes human in a white billowy shirt, and then he and Lois have sex on a giant silver beanbag. But on the way home, they stop at a diner. A bully beats Clark up, and he starts to realize that he may have made a mistake, especially when they see on the news that Zod has made it to the White House by this point and forced the president and other world leaders to fully abdicate their power to him. Clark realizes that this is his responsibility, and he screwed up. So he goes back to the fortress, gets his powers back, confronts Zod and his lackeys, who have now teamed up with Lex, fights them in the middle of Metropolis in a long fight where he's nearly killed. So then he lures them all back to the fortress, including Lex and Lois, where he uses the Red Sun superpower removing chamber to remove their superpowers. And then he and Lois tearfully acknowledge that if Clark stays Superman, it means they can't be together. So he super kisses her and makes her forget the events of the past few days. The end.
Yay.
So there's a lot.
There's so much. And that's just one of the movies.
Yeah, thanks to Twitter. We watched both cuts this week.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Twitter.
Thanks, Twitter.
No, I'm actually glad that we did, because they are very different. And
yeah,
we'll talk about the differences and which one is quote unquote better later. But I just want to say that about halfway through the Donner version, I did send Rebecca some all caps texts about my emotions. So get ready for that.
They did make me laugh because I had not watched it yet.
So yeah, let's start by talking about the theatrical version. And where better to start than with Superman himself?
Sounds good. It's kind of a weird movie for him because I personally didn't understand his emotional arc very much again.
Yeah.
To me, the biggest problem, and this is in both movies a little bit less in the Donner version, is that I don't understand the stakes of his choice between Lois and being Superman.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense because we're never given a reason that he has to give up his powers to be with her.
Exactly.
Literally, in either version. So, spoiler for later in our discussion, in the Lester version, all of this is communicated to him by a hologram of his mother, Lara. And in the Donner version, it's his father, Jor-El, played by Marlon Brando, who basically got cut because it would have cost too much money to have him come back for reshoots. But and he talks way more because he's a man.
But and he's Jor-El.
Right, and he's the worst. Can't wait to meet his dad. No. But in both versions, his parents are like, yeah, you have to give up your powers to be with this Earth lady. And Clark's like, okay. And at no point is he like, why? And neither of his parents offer a reason. It just is. Like, that it's just stated, and there's no... First of all, let's leave aside any, like, you can't have sex with her because you're too strong, the famous Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex essay.
Which I think this movie predates, right?
I believe so. But the whole idea, I just find really misogynistic, and yeah. I don't even want to touch it. So we're going to leave aside.
I mean, that's not part of what either Lara or Jor-El says in either.
No, it's not implied, and... I'm sure people have theorized that that's what it is, but that's gross, so.
Yeah.
And as the first movie establishes through subtext, he has all the necessary parts. He does eat.
It's barely subtext.
So it doesn't seem to be a physical thing.
Well, the only thing I could think of is that it's like about the tension between being sort of solitary and dedicating yourself to this like mission of saving people and saving the Earth versus being part of humanity and not having that role or something. But that tension doesn't exist for Superman specifically because he has a secret identity. He's Clark Kent.
Yeah.
So that's his way of being part of humanity either way. Him dating Lois is just part of that, and arguably not even, because she's dating him as a whole person, not just one persona.
Right, like it doesn't, if he can't be with Lois, then why can he wear regular pants and have a job? Like,
exactly.
It doesn't seem to be any different. And even that is, like, I would say that the Jor-El version does sort of imply that. There's a lot about giving up his mission to protect Earth. Jor-El doesn't say if you want to be with her, you can't protect Earth, but he does say if you're willing to give up your superpowers to be with her, you won't be able to protect Earth. Did you think about that? And Clark is like, screw Earth, I don't care, which is pretty awful of him. But there's none of that in Lara's version. She's just like, this is how it is, this is the deal. And it wouldn't bother me so much if this were I know it's really science fantasy more than science fiction, but if this were a fantasy story, if this was magic, and, you know, like, I need your voice to give you legs for 3 days, like, I'm okay with these arbitrary rules if it's magic, because you can just kind of assign those parameters to a spell, but it's not magic. It's supposed to be technology.
Yeah, it's pretty clear within the Superman mythos how his powers go away. It's not like he has to sacrifice a hair or whatever, like... I mean, also the central question I kept coming back to, besides why does he have to make this choice, is why didn't he tell Lois previously? It's made clear in the first act of the movie or so that he's into her and feels like he's being quote unquote friend zoned by her.
Which is so gross.
Yeah, which is a whole separate issue of like not a thing. But it made me wonder, like, why not just tell her, A, I want to date you, or B, I'm Superman, this is silly. Especially because if he's so willing to give up his powers and the potential of saving people for Lois when that is offered to him by his parents, why not just tell her sooner rather than actively gaslighting her over and over when she tries to get him to admit he's Superman?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the built-in problem with the concept of Superman. And he's got these two identities. He has to maintain the two identities. And his closest relationship is with one of the smartest people he knows. So it gets into this gaslighting place where he's consistently lying to her and tricking her to keep her from finding out, even though he knows that she is a person of courage and integrity, and he could just tell her. And it's that sort of little boy mentality that doesn't work as Clark is written to be a mature adult, and these stories aren't just for 5-year-old boys who don't want to tell their big sisters their secrets.
Well, I think in other versions of Superman adaptations, I'm okay with that tension because it seems like it's a big choice for Clark to give up whatever he has to give up, to be honest with her.
Yeah.
But the fact that we see in the movie that Lara/Jor-El is like, you want to give up your powers? And he's immediately like, yes. It's not a difficult decision for him at all. That's what makes all of those times before where he chose to not say anything completely empty.
Well, and that's the thing that you were saying when we talked about the first movie, which is that he has no interior life.
Right.
So we don't understand why he needs to maintain the Clark persona, because we don't understand what value that has to him, because it's only been like a few weeks that he's had it, and he doesn't have any friends. And he never hangs out with his mom, so, like, why even be Clark Kent? But on the other hand, he doesn't seem to care about being Superman or saving people, so why be Superman either? Why be anyone? This is depressing. I think he's depressed.
I mean, wouldn't you be if you had to stay in an ice house for 12 years listening to your dad talk to you?
Oh my God.
I can't get over that detail. It's the worst. I know we're just judging these movies as the movies, but I can't, it like sullies everything about the Superman to me.
It's just awful. But yeah, going back to the friend zone thing, the other issue with that is that he spends all this time, it's in both versions, but especially the Donner version, where he's like really passive aggressive and mopey and upset that Lois isn't into him as Clark. And it, like, that's clearly a persona.
Yeah, he's constantly like, oh, him again, every time she brings up Superman.
Yeah, and I can see a little bit of it if he played it off in sort of a more of a platonic way. Like, I don't see what's so great about this guy, and not, I don't see why you like him instead of me. Because then it would be bolstering his secret identity. Like, if he's not Superman, he would probably have an opinion about Superman. But instead, he, like, at one point when in the Donner version, when they get to the hotel at Niagara Falls, where they're supposed to pretend to be a married couple for their expose, he says something like, you know, I get the feeling that you're not happy being here with me, like in this romantic setting or whatever. And it's like, it's a job. You are just workplace harassing her now. It's a persistent problem with most forms of the Superman story. And except I do think that Lois and Clark sidestepped it really well. And actually, I will give credit to the current DCEU. I think that they sidestepped it really well.
Agree. It's my favorite thing about the DCEU, that she finds out immediately.
The moment at the end of Man of Steel when she says, welcome to the planet, it's, can that just be the whole movie? Like the scene where he flies and that's all we need.
It's so cheesy, though.
I don't care. I want Superman to be cheesy. Remember the part where we were going to ride around on a monorail? I want that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, she should say it while they're on the monorail. Welcome to the monorail.
You high-flying hero.
Anyway, so speaking of Lois, do we want to talk about her a little bit in this movie? Because she has kind of a interesting, weird journey to go on.
Yeah, definitely.
It's actually, I think, in the Lester version, that's one of the clearest signs of sort of cobbled together editing and story points for him to like get his his footage in there. Mm-hmm. That she has sort of double beats all over of her discovering that Clark is Superman, where initially she suspect. Why does she suspect it the first time? Because he saves the kid,
right? So they're when they're at Niagara Falls, there's this kid who's like climbing on the railing because there were no safety regulations to speak of in the 80s, I guess. And he falls over the falls, and Clark has walked away to get Lois a hot dog. And she starts screaming, "Somebody help!" Which is like, well, unless literally Superman is right there, there's nothing anybody can do.
Looking at my notes, actually, the thing that happens right before is they're standing next to the Niagara Falls, and Clark's glasses fog up.
Oh, right.
So she's like, "Oh, Clark, your glasses are fogging up. Let me help you." And he's like, "Oh, no." And she takes them off his face and is fixing them. And he's sort of like squirrely trying to make sure she doesn't look at him.
Yeah.
But then she does. And she has a moment where you think like, oh, she figured it out. That's all it took, which is totally reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
So when the kid jumped and she called somebody help, that I was interpreting that as, oh, she's subtly being like, "Superman, if you're here, wink, wink, you should help."
That makes sense. I mean, I definitely saw that as sort of queuing up her later realization where she notices the physical resemblance at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden Clark isn't there and Superman is there. And she harps on in both versions and in the first movie about how Clark is never there when Superman is there. But this is the first time that that's actually a logical point to notice.
Well, what's weird to me is part of it was the moment of her realizing after the kid gets rescued, I think, is left over from the original Donner version, where she like literally has a beat of, oh, she's figured it out. But then she confronts him about it and tries to, like, she jumps into the water to try to get him to admit it. And then when he manages to rescue her without turning into Superman, using heat vision mostly, she's like, oh, well, then I'll just let it go. I guess I was wrong. Sorry. So then the scene in the hotel room where he falls into the fire feels like they're starting the whole cycle over again.
Right.
She's completely decided he's not Superman at that point. And then he falls into the fire, which you're like, did he do that on purpose? And then they have an insane exchange where she's like, maybe you're in your heart. It's like, no, why would he trip? He's Superman.
He's super graceful.
Yeah, exactly. He wouldn't trip over something in a hotel room unless his subconscious really wanted her to know. But then it was like, well, why didn't he tell her in the 17 openings he had earlier that day?
He wanted to do it in their sexy hotel suite with the pink tiger skin rug and the massage bed, obviously.
But then as soon as they find out, they go
they
to
leave.
The fortress to have sex. So they don't even take advantage of the bed that, like, is electronic.
Which, by the way, like, that bed is gross, but it still seems better than the beanbag, which just looks, like, really uncomfortable. And, like, the minute you got even a little bit sweaty, it would stick to you.
And why did he have it up there? Multiple times people are like, is this your house? And he's like, no, I don't live here. Why does he have a giant sex bed?
You know, just in case. Well, I mean, there is the question of why did Jor-El give him a power removing chamber and a giant sex bed?
Yeah, that's my question.
Like, and then say, whatever you do, don't use either of these things. It's because Jor-El sucks, I mean.
And also they never explain in either movie how he gets his powers back later.
No, they do not.
It happens fully off screen and there's no explanation given at all. He just has to go back and be like, whoops, changed my mind.
It's slightly more explained in the Donner version, but we'll get to that. There was something else I wanted to say about Lois. Oh, you know, I think that the moment where she realizes for the, like, eighth time that he's Superman and it's actually proven, I got this kind of vibe with the Lester version, and actually it does tie into Clark getting his superpowers back. There are moments where it feels like he just got bored with it, and he was like, we'll just say that this happened and move on. So it kind of feels like he got bored with the whole is he or isn't he dance and just knocked Clark over. And then later he gets bored with the whole, oh no, he doesn't have superpowers, so now he does again. It's like he got distracted.
That Lester got distracted?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really feels like in an effort to make his cut, the 51%, he cut all the connective tissue.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a lot of, and not just in terms of making plot lines make sense, but just like between scenes of like, why are these people here? What are they doing? Is absent. It feels very disjointed, especially in the first half of the movie when we're dealing with Clark and Lois, Lex and Otis and Miss Tessmacher, and then Zod, Ursa, and Nan. They're fully three different movies.
Yeah, there's no interaction between any of
for
them
for a long time. It feels really disjointed, and I wonder if, like, in the edit bay, Lester was like, "We don't need this line that explains why we're here," because especially in watching the Donner cut, they existed. They're just not in the final movie.
I mean, there's even in like at a more micro level, like I'm just looking at my notes here with that opening sequence in Paris. There's so much in there that doesn't make any sense or that doesn't follow logical rules. Like one of the things that happens is that the terrorists release all the hostages that they have at the Eiffel Tower. And then they're just like, get out, we're releasing you, which is, I mean, I guess all of France is being held hostage because they have a nuke, but...
Right.
But why would they release the hostages? That's not explained. I mean, there's stuff like, you know, Lois climbs up to the top of the Eiffel Tower in like 5 minutes and is ready to go, which I've done that. And you're tired at the end and it takes like 2 hours. She even, this isn't really Lester's fault, but it annoyed me. She's writing all her notes for the story on her hand.
Yeah, what was that about?
What kind of reporter are you? Get a steno pad.
That sequence was so interesting to me because I feel like Lois Lane as a character who is really headstrong and like jumps into danger and sort of is super brave. Like she's often riding this line between brave and stupid.
Yeah.
And in the Paris sequence, I felt that she fell on the stupid side.
Absolutely.
Like when she shimmies underneath the Eiffel Tower elevator for no apparent reason. It seems like she's really winging it. She doesn't know what she's going to do when she gets up there. It doesn't feel like it's in pursuit of the story. It feels like she just needs to be where the action is, even though that action involves a nuclear weapon. And I think it was just lazy storytelling that has it come off this way, but it's such a waste of an amazing character.
Yeah.
When she just seems like she just disregards her own safety and Superman's of course going to have to save her because she got herself into the situation.
Yeah. There's a very like, oh, Lois finger wagging aspect to it, which I hate.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to what we talked about in the last episode about her not being able to spell and writing on her hand and all that. So I feel like these movies don't give Lois a ton of credit.
No. I do think that the Donner version does a little bit better in that in terms of her figuring out about Clark and mm-hmm. the strategy that she applies to do it. But I go back and forth about Margot Kidder's performance. There are moments where I really, really like her. But one of the things that people always say about her performance is that it's very manic, it's very frazzled, it's got that like neurotic 70s jittery vibe going on, and there is a confidence that I want to see in Lois that is sort of lacking from her performance and is replaced by this ditzy bravado, I guess. There's no underlying sense of she is gonna get this done because she's Lois and she's gotten herself out of worse scrapes before.
Yeah, she doesn't seem like she has a plan.
No, she just seems very sort of arbitrary and frayed at all times.
I will say I think her performance really works opposite Christopher Reeve. I think they have great chemistry, and I think she's grounded enough that it helps to ground him when he's being super goofy or Superman levels of stoic. And I think in scenes with him, she doesn't feel as manic and frazzled. I think she feels more together and that she's like got his number. And I think part of that is because these movies do a good job of sort of putting them on a similar playing field in terms of conversation. And I think when she's by herself doing reporting things, you don't buy it.
Yeah.
But when she's with him, you're like, I see what they see in each other.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually felt that some of the sparkle of that chemistry was lost when he admitted that he was Superman. Like there's a little bit of tension there that is really playful and fun.
Because the paradynamic is better.
Yeah.
Like in the scene where he's like helping her squeeze orange juice in the Lester version, even though it's riddled with the nice guy friend zone stuff, I think the paradynamic works because even though he knows he's Superman, she really feels superior to him as Clark. So they both have confidence and she's able to exert that confidence.
Yeah.
Whereas when he's Superman, A, she never questions his decision to keep it from her or chew him out or ask questions about it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also like so in the driver's seat from that point on because she knows everything that he's capable of. And I agree, it loses some of the magic.
It does. There's also, I did note that there's a really weird note to her performance in the fortress where she's almost acting like she's humoring a lunatic. Like, he's like, and over here, I have my talk to my space mom crystals. And she's like, wow, that's great. That's so cool. You said there's no phone here?
So do we want to talk about the differences with Lois and Clark in the Donner version now?
Yeah, we've hinted at it enough. So, well, first I should note that in the Donner version, it's literally like the next day or later that day. Like, he turns time back and then they like go back to the office and they're like, well, that was a fun time that we had out in California and arresting Lex Luthor.
And it's worth noting also that the Paris sequence doesn't exist.
Right.
The nuke that Lex launched to blow up the San Andreas Fault in the first movie is the nuke that opens the Phantom Zone, not the one from Paris.
Yes, which is much more seamless. It does make sense from a storytelling perspective, and it does also seem like, from what I've read online, the turning time back, like Lois dying and Clark turning time back, was supposed to happen at the end of the second movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a lot of sense from a storytelling perspective of, no, I'm giving this up so that I can be with Lois. Oh no, because I didn't have my powers, she died.
Right.
That is a much weightier decision. And it doesn't actually play off that way because she doesn't die in the second movie. But there was an idea there that could have been really powerful.
And if you do watch the Donner cut, they do use the footage of him turning time back.
Yes.
Rather than the amnesia kiss.
Yes. Which causes a lot more plot holes, but we'll get to those. So they return to the office after the events of the first movie, and literally Lois is just looking at her own article about Superman saving the day, and she glances over at Clark, and she notices the resemblance, and she starts doodling glasses, and I love this. It's not just glasses, it's a whole suit.
That fedora, yeah.
Yeah. On the picture of Superman in the paper, and she's like, okay, yeah, that's the same guy.
I did kind of want a little bit more of a why now with that. It's like a really funny bit.
Yeah.
But I guess it may make more sense if it's clearer that it was like literally the next day and she's just had time to sit with this information.
That's the thing.
But he literally just walks in and she's like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, she hasn't seen either of them more than like four times maybe. So yeah. I buy it here. Although it does make a lot of other stuff in the movie completely incomprehensible because people keep acting like a lot of time has passed, and I'm like, no, it's the next day. Like, Lex says something about how patient he's been in jail, and I'm like, you've been in jail for 8 hours. But anyway, she goes over to Clark and she's like, okay, this is clearly you, and he's like, oh, Lois, no.
I truly love that she doesn't even try to trick him. She's like, hey, by the way.
Yeah, she's like, so you're Superman, right? And he's like, nuh-uh. And she's like, yahan, I'm going to prove it. And then she just hurls herself out the window. And Clark uses super speed to race down there, prop up. There's like a fruit stand with an awning underneath the entrance to the Daily Planet. So he props up the awning and he, you know, uses a whole bunch of superpowers. There's super breath and all sorts of stuff. And there's wind blowing everywhere, and like some woman's skirt flies up, so we see her panties, and it's great because this sequence allows Donner to humiliate two women at once. And Lois crashes into the awning and through it and into the fruit, and she's very embarrassed, but she's not hurt. And she's like, oh, I guess I was wrong.
Yeah, she's like, that's egg on my face. I sure did try to kill myself.
And I do legitimately think that she was like, oh, maybe I was wrong there. But then she goes, when they go to Niagara Falls and Clark saves the little boy, or Superman shows up out of nowhere and saves the little boy, which also, there's still a lot of jokes about her drinking orange juice in the Donner version, but they never set that up in that version. So it's like, I guess Lois just loves that vitamin C.
Yeah, in the Lester version, there's a scene where she's making orange juice and telling him that it's about being healthy while she's smoking cigarettes. I don't know why it becomes a runner through the movie.
Yeah, which the cigarette thing is so weird from a modern perspective, especially like in the final fight scene. There's that Marlboro truck that they keep crashing into.
Oh my God, there's so much product placement in that final fight.
There's so much product placement, but especially like the cigarettes. And this movie was intended mostly for kids. It's,
well, the joke with the orange juice is that cigarettes are unhealthy, but they never really like put a bow on it.
No.
It's very strange.
Anyway, I digress. The point is, she sees Superman show up out of nowhere to save this kid and fly off. And Clark happens to not be around when that occurs.
I also think the foggy glasses bit doesn't exist in this version.
I think you're right, yeah. So she's like, So they go back to their hotel room, and this is the bit that was actually cobbled together from two different screen tests. So I want to say that in his, he was playing off of a different actress, and in hers, he was actually, like, Christopher Reeve was actually there, but I could be wrong about that. But her hair is totally different. Like, they look totally
His
different.
His glasses are totally different.
Right, right, because they're screen tests. But she's sitting there, and she basically says, I still think you're Superman. And he's like, that's crazy talk. Didn't I already prove that I wasn't when you jumped out the window? And she says, no, my mistake was in risking my life and not yours. And she pulls out a gun and shoots him.
This moment is so amazing.
It's so good. And this is the moment where I texted you and wrote and said, the Donner version is better and I'm mad about it. Because she just shoots him.
If you don't want to watch the whole Donner version, which I don't blame you, just watch the scene.
This scene is so good.
Absolutely worth it.
I bet it's on YouTube. Yeah. So she shoots him and he does that great Christopher Reeve body language thing where he's like, and then he sort of straightens up and is clearly Superman, even though he hasn't changed anything but his posture. And he says, you know, you could have hurt somebody with that stunt if I wasn't Superman.
He says, you would have hurt Clark Kent, which is, I think, the only time he speaks in the third person.
Yeah. And she goes with a blank and gives him this, haha, got you look. And his look of, oh, that's egg on my face is so good. He's like, you got me.
Especially because he drops the act immediately when the gun goes off. He straightens up immediately.
Yeah.
And he's like completely given up the ruse at this point. He's no longer trying to gaslight her. And then she's like, gotcha. And he's like, damn it, I probably could have gotten out of this one too.
Yeah, like she just outsmarts him. She doesn't actually endanger anybody. She's just smarter.
It's really good.
It's so good. The chemistry is so good, even if they were only in the room with each other half of the time, and it's so playful, and it's wonderful. It's so good.
We'll put the YouTube link to this in the show notes. I found it on YouTube.
Yeah. So that is definitely a superior version, and it takes away the whole Lois having the same beat over and over again. It feels much more like she has come up with a theory, and she's going to test it a few ways.
Yeah, it's like the scientific method.
Exactly.
More than just fumbling around, which is, you know.
Hypothesis. Hot coworker is hot superhero.
Exactly. I mean, it feels, again, going back to the power dynamic, she feels so much more in control. Like, when she jumps into the water in the Lester version, when they're at Niagara, it feels kind of like a lark, and you're left with the impression that she's being sort of silly.
Yeah.
But her, like, absolute balls out commitment to both jumping out the window of the Daily Planet and pulling a gun on Clark shows how confident and sure she is in her convictions.
Which also, she totally got a gun and loaded it with blanks and took it to Niagara Falls because she knew they'd be sharing a hotel room.
Yeah, it's so good. And she waited first for something that like really put her over the edge of being sure. When he saves the kid, she's like, well, now I gotta take the gun out.
Yeah.
Why did Perry send them to Niagara?
They're supposed to do an expose on how these honeymoon hotels are fleecing young newlyweds out of their money.
That feels like a waste of two good reporters to me.
It's a huge waste.
This is just a side note. I feel like there's a lot of pop culture references to this, to Superman 2, more so than you might see for other sequels besides like The Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. And then no references to Superman 3 except for Office Space and no references to Superman 4, period.
That's not wrong. Like Neil Before Zod entered the vernacular immediately.
Yeah.
Which is a great segue to talk about Zod.
Well, I want to ask you, because you're more of a comic scholar, is Zod from comics or was he created for this movie?
I can't believe you stumped me that fast.
I have never seen him in a comic that predates 1980.
No, the character first appeared in Adventure Comics number 283, April 1961.
Wow.
Yeah, I've definitely seen him in Silver Age stuff. But, you know, he had like a little headband and stuff. He looked different. But the whole idea of the Phantom Zone is a very Silver Age idea. And the Silver Age, I mean, comics in general, but especially the Silver Age, loves punishments that are like, well, we can't kill you, so we're going to do the more humane thing, which is turn you into a ghost and make you float through nothing for eternity with every asshole we know.
I mean, in the Lesser Cut specifically, there's a ton of weird power stuff.
Yeah.
That is never explained. Specifically, the amnesia kiss, of course, mm-hmm. is never set up and is not a thing. And then the fight that he has with Zod and the others in the fortress, Zod has like telekinesis throughout the movie,
yep.
but like using I-beams. And then in the fortress, Superman can like duplicate himself like Loki.
Yep.
Into holograms.
Well, and also it seems like Zod and the others can teleport. And
yes.
At one point they all point at Clark and it seems to be basically heat vision out of their fingers.
Yeah.
And then of course the second most infamous made up power for this movie after the super kiss is when Clark takes the shield off of his chest. He like peels off a layer of it because it's still there and he throws it at Non and it gets giant and turns into cellophane and wraps around Non and then immediately disappears. So it accomplished nothing. But we did get a question on Twitter about which version that was in. It's the Lester version because,
yes.
Again, Lester clearly did not give a damn and thought this was really silly and wanted everybody else to think it was silly, too.
Do you think that's why? Because, like, I'm not going to be push my glasses up my nose and complain that it's not canonically accurate or whatever, necessarily. I think probably in 1980, people didn't really care. But it just feels unmotivated and extra to just give these other powers when Superman's existing powers, of which they are many, would be totally sufficient.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's so powerful that giving any of them additional powers is like, you didn't need to. And also some powers are missing. Like there are scenes that clearly demonstrate they don't have super hearing.
Oh, that's so true. Like when Clark quote unquote whispers to Lex, yep. but is talking in full voice 3 feet away from Zod.
Exactly. And there's a shot of Zod, like a close up of him not hearing any of this. But we did say we were going to talk about the villains, and then we didn't do that at all.
And let's go back to it.
Let's go back to it. So speaking of Zod, which we haven't made any Neil Before Pod jokes yet in this episode.
We did it so good in our first episode, I think.
We did. We did.
It's hovering over this whole recording.
We also haven't made enough Superman 2 Sue Harder jokes, so let's improve on that.
You mean Superman 2 Havana Nights?
Yeah, Superman 2 Soup Up to the Streets.
You mean two super, two man?
Superman 2, here we go again. Anyway, we're sorry, listeners. We apparently really don't want to talk about Zod. So he sucks.
I feel like he sucks asterisks. Like, he Yay! Sucks less than other Superman villains.
That's
have.
True. That's true. He is one, like, I mean, that's part of the problem with Superman as a character, that he is so powerful that there are very few villains who can really give him a fight. So it's a limited field. And I think Zod, you know, he's a good addition to it. It's more, all three of the evil Kryptonians have this very weird approach to their performance, which is like almost Shakespearean by way of silent movie actor. It's like very pantomimey and over the top and strange. And they're also like, you don't think that wire work is necessarily a skill, but they don't look nearly as good in flight as Christopher Reeve does. Like, he manages to pull it off and they look very silly.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, another issue is that there's very little development for Zod, and there's almost no development for Ursa and Nan. Nan's, like, character trait is that he doesn't speak.
Yeah, and he's big.
Which is a strange choice. Yeah, he's big, but it doesn't really impact his physicality at all. In fact, in the Lester version, there's a runner where he can't get his powers to work.
Yeah.
Ursa has an almost interesting bit where she keeps taking, like, insignias of authority and sticking them to herself.
It's actually really cute.
It's pretty funny, and I think it's actually really good character development. I think, especially because she and Zod, their whole thing is being in authority and being the most in charge. And it's kind of an interesting, subtle thing that I kind of wanted to see more of.
Yeah, she's like a little magpie.
Yeah, she's almost interesting.
Yeah.
But Zod, I mean, Zod as a character who is as strong as Superman, I think is good because he also represents Superman's heritage coming to bite him in the butt, mm-hmm. essentially. Like, I think, you know, Zod's revenge against Jor-El thing is boring because who cares about Jor-El?
Yeah.
But at least the idea that, like, it's another Kryptonian and he wants to kill Clark is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Although the movies, both cuts of the movie don't do a ton with it, especially because Jor-El's not in the original, in the Lester cut. So it's absolute nonsense.
Well, also, I mean, a big part of the problem is that Zod does not know that Jor-El's son is alive and on this planet that he's happened to find himself on until Lex tells him, which is like a good hour into the movie. And Clark does not find out either that, well, he doesn't find out that Zod and the others are on Earth until 3/4 of the way through the Lester cut, halfway through the Donner cut. And he doesn't find out that Lex broke out of jail until he just gets to the Daily Planet office and sees him there when he goes to confront Zod. So I know we spent a lot of time talking about Lois and Clark and their shenanigans together. And of course, that is a thing that we love, but in general, not necessarily in every version of this movie, but you kind of need, like, the good guy to be aware that there's a bad guy and that he should be doing something about it. Like, I can kind of see why Clark would give up his superpowers, because as far as he knows, he arrested Lex Luthor and now crime is done.
Right. I mean, part of the problem is we never see Clark learning that Zod is a Kryptonian who wants revenge against his dad, and he doesn't have to deal with it at all because he has no interior life. And then I think it would work if we didn't have to spend so much time with Zod at all, and it was more about Clark making the decision to be Superman and protect people. Like, I think the moment where he sees Zod on TV and is like, oh, I screwed up, I gotta go get my powers back, does work because he's like, this is my mess to clean up. But because we're asked to care about Zod also, that doesn't really feel satisfying. He's not just a device. We're supposed to also want to know what he wants.
Yeah, which just seems to be conquering the Earth and sticking it to Jor-El.
Yeah, he just likes being in charge.
Yeah, which is not a very nuanced driving force.
That said, I do really like Terrence Stamp in this part.
He's having a lot of fun.
He is.
Which is, it's always enjoyable to see someone having a good time playing a particular role, which is why Jeff Goldblum is such a popular actor.
I'm so glad he's finally in superhero movies.
Yeah. What if he was Jor-El?
What if he was Zod?
What if he was everyone in these movies?
What if everyone on Krypton looked like Jeff Goldblum?
One thing that I will note about Ursa is that, okay, first of all, she has these, like, giant slits in her pants. Like, she's wearing thigh-high boots.
Yeah, they're super weird.
But then there's slits in her pants that go up to, like, basically her waist, which is gross. But also, especially in the Donner version, she has all these, like, weird sexist comments.
Mm.
But it just seems extremely arbitrary just to get those snide comments in there.
The ones she makes against Lois?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you, really?
Yeah, all that stuff. There seemed to be this desire to set up a catfight between Ursa and Lois, which is like, well, okay, first of all, Lois will die. And second of all, why?
I will say, in the Lois versus Ursa runner, my favorite moment was when they're at the Daily Planet and Perry has been knocked out and she's like cradling Perry's unconscious body. And then Ursa makes like a snide comment about her, and she full on drops Perry's body to punch her in the face.
Yeah.
She doesn't get the punch in, but it's really funny.
It's perfect. It's like perfect Lois. I love that beat.
Yeah, 100%. It was one of my favorite Lois moments in the movie.
Yeah.
My question was, why do the Kryptonians know about Earth poetry and think it's important to teach Clark about it? When Lex is in the fortress with Miss Tessmacher and he puts the data crystal in the thing and a hologram pops up, it's just a general man in the Lester version and Jor-El in the Donner version. They recite the I've never seen a poem as lovely as a tree poem.
Yeah, in both versions. Like, that's how important it was. They kept it in both versions.
Like, they're sending him to Earth. They don't think Earth is going to teach him about Earth poems?
Well, also, how does Jor-El know about Earth poems and Zod doesn't even know the name of the planet?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. At least he maybe knows what Earth is but doesn't realize that Houston is not Earth. But then when he shows up, he should be like, oh, I know a lot about Earth. For instance, I heard you have great tree poems. I just don't understand.
I mean, does Krypton even have trees? Are they like,
no.
What the hell is this poem about?
Maybe they're like, my son, when you arrive on Earth, you're going to need to know what a tree is.
We're going to teach you via poetry.
Also, that scene with the astronauts when they first arrive on Earth has a very weird gay panic in space joke.
Yeah. Like, the mission control guy is like, hey, so how's everything going up there on the moon? And the astronaut's like, oh, it's good. Me and Boris are engaged, which is like a joke. It's like a joke about how now that the US and Russia are working together on this space mission, the Cold War is over or whatever. But there's also that joke with Lex in prison where he says to another prisoner, I want my Liberace albums back. And we spent like 10 minutes before we started recording trying to figure out if that was like a gay prison sex joke or not, like what that was supposed to be, and we're not sure.
Well, I don't even understand, does Lex really have Liberace albums, or was he trying to embarrass the other guy by implying that he has Liberace albums?
There's a lot of questions.
I mean, there's a lot we can't know from 2018, and one of those main questions is, what did people actually think of Liberace in 1980?
Yeah, if anybody who's older than us would like to give us some feedback on that, that email is flightsandtightspodcast@gmail.com.
Or tweet at us at flightstights.
Speaking of Lex, because that's yet another completely separate plotline for a while.
And it's so boring.
It's really boring, although I will say, once Lex hooks up with the Kryptonians, I like him a lot better.
Yeah, well, he's actually able to be a villain.
Yeah, and I think he's very funny playing off straight men instead of morons.
Totally agree.
His dynamic with the Kryptonians is really entertaining, and also his shameless flipping back and forth to whoever is going to keep him safe from the other side. Like, that's all very entertaining, and I liked it a lot. But yeah, the beginning, like, we had to put up with more Otis.
I do want to say, before we blow past the boring Lex stuff, the bit where when he's breaking out of prison and he's created a hologram of him and Otis playing chess is like a really good bit.
It is. I like that bit.
The prison guard goes into the cell because it looks like they're playing chess, and then he stands in front of the projector and it's just an image of them playing chess and they've actually escaped. That's a really good Lex Luthor escaping prison bit.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. So the Donner version does make the relationship between Lex and Miss Tessmacher more clear, where they appear to have a romantic relationship in that version.
Mm.
But I don't understand, whether they're co-workers or dating or both, why would she continue to associate with a man who attempted to kill her mother?
Exactly.
And why would he continue to associate with a woman who betrayed him to Superman?
I mean, on the Lex side of it, I guess he just doesn't have anybody else to help him since Otis is in jail.
Aww.
But not aw.
But he's so lonely.
But yeah, that was my number one question. Is the second Miss Tessmacher showed up, I was like, he literally tried to nuke your mom. Like, I think probably Lex doesn't give her enough credit for being smart enough to sort of have a mutiny against him. But she absolutely could have not brought her hot air balloon to the prison to try to get him to escape and risk her own safety.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
That said, my favorite bit between the two of them in this movie was when they show up at the fortress and he's like, whoa, this place has everything. And she says, not everything. And he says, I told you to go before we left.
And she's like, that was 3 days ago.
It's pretty funny. I'll give it to him. I enjoyed that more than anything with them in the first movie.
And then he like goes on and he's like listening to all the holograms and stuff. And that goes on for a while. And at the very end, you hear a flush and she goes, found it. Which was pretty cute.
She's great. I want a spin-off show about her where Superman's not allowed to show up.
I enjoy her.
Superman should show up.
I will say one of the things that I really like about Lex in this movie is that he's wearing an ascot even with his prison stripes, which to me like is in keeping with my personal headcanon that all Luthers are always like drinking port and listening to Wagner while lying on a tiger skin rug and talking about Alexander the Great or whatever. So that was primo Lex. I enjoyed that.
But that goes back to the Liberace question. Is Lex coded as gay in these movies?
I don't know.
Again, if you were alive in 1980, please let us know.
Yeah, we need some assistance here. So one of the things that we've sort of touched on it in a couple of places. We haven't really dug into it. The Lester version has a lot of slapstick. Like, it's really, really silly. And now that... Because I didn't know the first time I saw this movie. Like, I didn't know anything about his body of work. And now I'm like, okay, I can see how this guy also directed A Hard Day's Night. Like, that kind of links up for me. Like, there's... During the big fight scene at the end, for example, there's this really dramatic moment where Zod and Ursa throw a bus full of people at Clark, and he's begging them not to do it because the bus is full of people, but they do it anyway, and it crashes into him, and some people go, they run over to go look, and they're like, yep, he's dead, and Lois is like, oh, and people start climbing out of the bus, and all the people standing around are like, they just killed Superman, and somebody says, let's get them, and then they all start marching towards the Kryptonians to attack them, which is fine with me, because it's one of my favorite tropes. It's a beat that I really, really love. And I do think these movies do a really great job of establishing this dynamic. I mean, it comes out of nowhere because Clark's only been around for 45 minutes and doesn't care about people. But when he interacts with other human beings, they all react to him as if he's their buddy, which I think is really cute. So you have this double beat here where, first of all, we don't actually think Superman's dead, but maybe Superman is dead. And second of all, you have the people of Metropolis, like, joining together to fight off this overwhelming threat because they love their hero. And those are both potentially very powerful moments. And what Lester does with those moments is have the Kryptonians start using their super breath to blow the humans away.
Forever.
And I time this. It's 2.5 minutes long, which is an enormous amount of time in a movie of them just blowing and then all of these slapstick jokes happening because of it. Like one guy's eating an ice cream cone and the ice cream blows off and splats on some other guy's face. Or one guy's talking on the phone in a phone booth and the phone booth gets knocked over and blows away and the guy's just lying there on the ground still talking on the phone. Which is also like, did you not notice anything that's okay?
It feels very much to me like they spent a lot of money and damn it, they were going to use everything they shot.
Yeah, but it's like, not only is it not funny because it's way too long, but it's not an appropriate time to be funny. And I feel like that sensibility happens over and over again. I feel like that sensibility combined with just a general sense of impatience and not caring about the mythology and just, I don't know, he has his powers back. I don't care. Yeah, she just figured it out now. I'm bored. Those are the two things that undermine this movie the most.
Well, I think your hypothesis that he doesn't think Superman is, like, he thinks Superman is silly and he wants you to also think that also extends to how Clark is, where he's a lot goofier. There's a lot more physical comedy with him. Mm-hmm. It has an overall effect on the tone of the movie.
Yeah, and I think, so one of the other things that I came across while I was doing research for this episode was a lot of people felt that way about Superman. Like, the original Mario Puzo screenplay that was handed in before they did a lot of work on it, because they did not film that screenplay. Like, he may be credited with it, but there were a lot of changes. There were a lot of rewrites. Apparently it was, like, super, super goofy. And even Marlon Brando, I mean, this seems to be partially Marlon Brando just kind of being a dick and enjoying messing with directors, but he kept making suggestions like, why would Jor-El look like a human if he's a dead space ghost? Maybe he should look like a bagel. Yeah, no, that's the thing. He was like, maybe he looks like a suitcase.
To be fair, this was like 10 years after the Adam West Batman went off the air.
Right, so Superman had not been a mass market vehicle since the George Reeves show in the 50s. And since then, he'd only really been seen in like Super Friends, which was A, for very young children, and B, very silly.
Yeah.
And when your primary sources and references for superhero material are Super Friends and the Adam West show, and they're both pretty old, then it doesn't surprise me that so many people would approach this material as just totally ridiculous. And a lot of it is ridiculous, and that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, like, it's not to say that we want this taken deadly seriously, because
then you get Man of Steel.
Hypothetically, a gritty Superman movie is a nightmare, but there's a balance to taking the material seriously, but also finding a good tone to strike.
Yeah.
A fun tone.
Yeah, and just picking one.
Yeah, just do that. Which I feel like brings us to the diner sequence, which appears in both films.
Oh, God.
Which I feel like is really indicative of the interpretation of Superman in this movie. In both versions, Clark and Lois are on their way back from the fortress. They haven't yet heard about Zod taking over the White House. And they go into a diner so Lois can get food. And a guy is just a real asshole to Clark. And Clark, who is just newly given his powers up, is like, I'm gonna have a fight with this guy, and he gets beaten to a pulp. So at the end of the movie, after he's gotten his powers back and taken down Zod and the others and put them in the Phantom Zone, he goes back to the diner, antagonizes the jerk, and then essentially throws him out of the diner. Like, he absolutely beats him up, and it's the end of the movie. It's such a strange way to deal with this character. It's like the least Supermanly thing he does in the whole movie.
It's wildly out of character. It's so vicious and mean-spirited, yeah. And it's
vindictive.
Worse. It's vindictive, and it's worse in the Donner version, because instead of just giving Lois amnesia, he erases the events of the past couple of days.
That's so true.
This guy, even though Clark remembers being beaten up by this guy, that didn't actually happen. And so he's literally, I mean, it's the same footage because they didn't shoot it twice. Donner originally filmed the sequence, so they didn't need to reshoot it. So they all act like they've seen Clark before, but they haven't actually. So in the Donner version, he's literally just walking into a diner where, as far as anyone else knows, he's never been before, marching over to some guy and beating the crap out of him.
Like, to an extent where people should be like, wait, are you Superman?
Yeah.
Like, to a superhuman level, he beats the crap out of him.
It is awful.
And he's really just smug about it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it feels very much like nerd fan service in the most toxic way. Especially because initially he gets into this fight to, like, protect his woman. And now I guess he feels bad that he can't be with her. So he's working that out by swinging his dick around? I don't know.
I mean, one of the best things about Superman is you'd think he's fully above this whole situation. He doesn't, like, brace yourself because I'm about to compare Man of Steel favorably to this. But in Man of Steel, there's a similar scene in the earlier part of the movie where a guy is a jerk to a waitress and Clark is like, please leave. And the guy dumps beer on him. So Clark just walks out. I don't know why that guy would antagonize Clark in Man of Steel, because he is like 7 feet tall, but there you go. And then the way Clark retaliates is he sticks a telephone pole through the guy's truck, which is insane.
Yeah.
That part I don't like about it.
No.
But the fact that he sort of chooses to not engage in an altercation because he's like, I could literally murder this person and grind his bones up, but that I don't care. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And he just chooses to leave. Makes so much more sense for the character than being like, well, when I have the opportunity, I'm going to completely beat you up.
I mean, we've discussed this also, and there's also a version like this in the Smallville pilot, where the school bully is being a dick to him, so he just, like, stacks a bunch of the football team's cars on top of each other, which is actually pretty funny.
And it is.
He also, he gets away with it because in that version, he's 14 years old. The other versions, he's 30.
But it's also funny because Clark gets the satisfaction of having screwed with this guy, but he doesn't make it about him. He just makes it about this guy having to deal with something that's inconvenient, essentially.
Yeah.
Whereas Clark in Superman 2, beating up the diner guy in front of all of the patrons and the waitress who are like, what the hell just happened? He just slid the guy down the bar like it was no big deal. There's a million reasons to not do it that way.
Yeah, it's vindictive and it's illogical, and I wish it wasn't in there. And for some reason, it's like lauded as one of the best scenes in the movie. And I'm like, no, no, it's bad. It's a bad scene.
So horrible.
It should be gone.
It just bums me out. It's such a bummer to see Superman be mean to somebody who can't defend themselves against him.
Yeah.
It's a bully move, honestly. Yeah. And Superman's the opposite of a bully.
Yeah, no, I'm not about it. Also, another thing about that scene. So he starts bleeding when the bully beats him up.
When he starts bleeding, he's like, I'm bleeding. It's like, yeah, dude, you turned yourself into a human, remember?
He goes, blood, my blood.
Yeah, uh-huh, yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's inside
that's
of
so
you.
So silly.
But also, here's my question. Where the hell is this diner? Because he's still bleeding.
In the North Pole?
He hitchhiked from the diner to the North Pole, and he's still actively bleeding. Like, that blood is still wet. It has not congealed in any way. It doesn't make any sense at all. Also, they just leave Lex there at the end.
Well, I was actually going to ask, because Clark destroys the fortress.
Oh, right.
Did Lex die?
Yeah.
Does he just kill Lex?
Well, he did kill Zod.
That's true.
And Lois kills Ursa, and Non kind of falls to his own death because he's an idiot. Like, Lois straight up murders somebody in this movie.
And Clark.
Which a lot of people, after Man of Steel came out, a lot of people were like, well, this isn't the first time that Superman has killed someone. He kills the Kryptonians in Superman 2, which, as we just said, is not entirely accurate because Lois has her fair share of it. But that doesn't make it any better of a move for Superman to do. Like, he just shouldn't kill anyone in the end.
No, he shouldn't even beat people up in diners.
No, we're all very disappointed. He should talk to his mother more. That's the problem. To Martha, I mean. He knows enough about trees now. He needs to learn more about morals.
Well, to segue into next episode, I believe Clark does return to Smallville, but I don't know if Martha is there, so we're going to have to find out together.
Yeah, I'm excited. I've never actually seen Superman 3.
Well, now that we know that Marlon Brando and Richard Pryor allegedly had a relationship, it really feels more like part of the franchise.
Oh, yeah. That's going to add some interesting subtext to whatever's going on in that movie.
So join us in the next episode for Superman 3, which only has one release version and is therefore probably a perfect movie, no problems.
Yeah, sure.
And make sure you subscribe to us on SoundCloud at Flights Tights to find out as soon as the next episode drops. Follow us on Twitter or Tumblr, also at Flights Tights. And as we mentioned, if you have any comments, questions, if you want to argue with us about our bad opinions,
tell us more about Liberace.
Absolutely. Please email us flightsandtightspodcast@gmail.com. So that's our show.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. See you guys next time.
Kneel before pod.
Kneel before pod. What if everyone on Krypton looked like Jeff Goldblum?